Us? Me and you. Years ago. We've been together for years, Chris. Years and years. I focus on the picture. Images come to me, the two of us, a sunny afternoon. We'd hired a boat somewhere. I don't know where. He holds up another picture. We're much older now. It looks recent. We're standing outside a church. The day is overcast, and he's wearing a suit and shaking hands with a man also in a suit. I'm wearing a hat, which I seem to be having difficulty with. I'm holding it as if it is in danger of blowing off in the wind. I'm not looking at the camera. "That was just a few weeks ago," he says. "Some friends of us invited us to their daughter's wedding, do you remember?" "No," I say angrily. "No, I don't remember." "It was a lovely day," he says, turning the picture back to look at it himself. "Lovely." I remember reading what Claire had said when I told her I'd found a newspaper clipping about Adam's death. It can't have been real. "Show me one of Adam," I say.
"Go on. Show me just one picture of him."
"Adam is dead," he says. "A soldier's death. Noble. He died a hero." I shout.
"You should still have a picture of him. Show me."
He takes out the picture of Adam with Helen, the one I've already seen. Fury rises in me.
"Show me just one picture of Adam with you in it. Just one. You must have some, surely, if you're his father."
He looks through the photographs in his hand, and I think he will produce a picture of the two of them, but he does not. His arms hang at his side. "I don't have one with me," he says. "They must be at the house."
"You're not his father, are you?"
I say. "What father wouldn't have pictures of himself with his son?" His eyes narrow, as if in rage, but I cannot stop. "And what kind of father would tell his wife that their son is dead, when he isn't?"
"Admit it. You're not Adam's father. Ben is."
Even as I said the name, an image came to me. A man with narrow, dark-rimmed glasses and black hair. Ben. I say his name again, as if to lock the image in my mind. Ben. The name has an effect on the man standing in front of me. He says something, but too quietly for me to hear it, and so I ask him to repeat it. "You don't need Adam," he says.
"What?"
I say, and he speaks more firmly, looking into my eyes as he does so. "You don't need Adam. You have me now. We're together. You don't need Adam. You don't need Ben." At his words, I feel all the strength I had within me disappear, and as it goes, he seems to recover. I sink to the floor. He smiles. "Don't be upset," he says brightly. "What does it matter? I love you. That's all that's important, surely. I love you, and you love me." He crouches down, holding out his hands towards me. He is smiling, as if I am an animal that he is trying to coax out of the hole in which it has hidden.
"Come," he says. "Come to me."
I shift further back, sliding on my haunches. I hit something solid and feel the warm, sticky radiator behind me. I realize I am under the window at the far end of the room. He advances slowly.
"Who are you?"
I say again, trying to keep my voice even, calm. "What do you want?" He stops moving. He is crouched in front of me. If he were to reach out, he could touch my foot, my knee. If he were to move closer, I might be able to kick him, should I need to, though I am not sure I could reach, and in any case, I'm barefoot.
"What do I want?"
he says.
"I don't want anything. I just want us to be happy, Chris. Like we used to be.
Do you remember?" That word again. Remember. For a moment I think perhaps he's being sarcastic.
"I don't know who you are," I say, near hysterical. "How can I remember? I've never met you before."
His smile vanishes then. I see his face collapse in on itself with pain. There is a moment of limbo, as if the balance of power is shifting from him to me. And for a fraction of a second, it's equal between us.
He becomes animated again.
But you love me, he says. I read it, in your journal. You said you love me. I know you want us to be together. Why can't you remember that?
My journal, I say.
I know he must have known about it. How else did he remove those vital pages? But now I realized he must have been reading it for a while, at least since I first told him about it a week ago. How long have you been reading my journal? He doesn't seem to have heard me. He raises his voice, as if in triumph.
Tell me you don't love me, he says.
I say nothing.
See? You can't, can you? You can't say it.
Because you do. You always have done, Chris. Always. He rocks back, and the two of us sit on the floor, opposite each other.
I remember when we met, he says.
I think of what he's told me. Spilt coffee in the university library, and wonder what is coming now.
You were working on something. Always writing.
You used to go to the same cafe every day.
You always sat in the window, in the same seat.
Sometimes you had a child with you, but usually not. You would sit with a notebook open in front of you, either writing or sometimes just looking out of the window. I thought you looked so beautiful. I used to walk past you, every day on my way to catch the bus, and I started to look forward to my walk home so that I could catch a glimpse of you.
I used to try and guess what you might be wearing, or whether you'd have your hair pulled back or loose, or whether you'd have a snack, a cake, or a sandwich. Sometimes you'd have a whole flapjack in front of you, sometimes just a plate of crumbs, or even nothing at all, just the tea.
He laughs, shaking his head sadly. And I remember Claire telling me about the cafe, and know that he is speaking the truth. I would come past at exactly the same time every day, he says.
And no matter how hard I tried, I just couldn't work out how you decided when to eat your snack.
At first I thought maybe it depended on the day of the week, but it didn't seem to follow any pattern there. So then I thought perhaps it was related to the date, but that didn't work either. I started to wonder what time you actually ordered your snack. I thought maybe that was related to the time that you got to the cafe, so I started to leave work earlier and run so that I could maybe see you arriving. And then, one day, you weren't there. I waited until I saw you coming down the street. You were pushing a buggy, and when you got to the cafe door you seemed to have trouble getting it in. You looked so helpless and stuck, and without thinking I walked over the road and held the door for you. And you smiled at me and said, "Thank you so much." You look so beautiful, Christine. I wanted to kiss you there and then, but I couldn't. And because I didn't want you to think that I'd run across the road just to help you, I went into the cafe too, and stood behind you in the queue. You spoke to me as we waited. "Busy today, isn't it?" you said. And I said, "Yes," even though it wasn't particularly busy for that time of day. I just wanted to carry on making conversation. I ordered a drink, and I had the same cake as you, too, and wondered if I should ask you whether it would be okay for me to sit with you. But by the time I'd got my tea, you were chatting to someone. One of the people who ran the cafe, I think. And so I sat on my own in the corner. After that, I used to go to the cafe almost every day. It's always easier to do something when you've done it once. Sometimes I'd wait for you to arrive, or make sure you were there before I went in. But sometimes I'd just go in anyway. And you noticed me.
I know you did. You began to say hello to me, or you'd comment on the weather. And then one time I was held up, and when I arrived you actually said, "You're late today," as I walked past holding my tea and my flapjack. And when you saw that there were no free tables, you said, "Why don't you sit here?" And you pointed to the chair at your table opposite you. The baby wasn't there that day, so I said, "Are you sure you don't mind? I won't disturb you." And then I felt bad for saying that, and I dreaded you saying that yes, actually, on second thoughts it would disturb you. But you didn't. You said,
"No, not at all. To be honest, it's not going too well anyway. I'd be glad of a distraction."
And that was how I knew that you wanted me to speak to you, rather than just have my drink and eat my cake in silence.
Do you remember?
I shake my head. I have decided to let him speak. I want to find out everything he has to say.
So I sat, and we chatted.
You told me you were a writer. You said you'd had a book published, but you were struggling with your second one. I asked you what it was about, but you wouldn't tell me. It's fiction, you said. And then you said, supposedly. And you suddenly looked very sad. So I offered to buy you another cup of coffee. You said that would be nice, but that you didn't have any money with you to buy me one. I don't bring my purse when I come here, you said. I just bring enough money to buy one drink and one snack. That way I'm not tempted to pig out. I thought it was an odd thing to say. You didn't look as though you needed to worry about how much you ate at all. You were always so slim. But anyway, I was glad, as it meant you must be enjoying speaking to me, and you would owe me a drink, so we'd have to see each other again. I said that it didn't matter about the money, or buying me one back. And I got us some more tea and coffee. After that, we started to meet quite regularly. I begin to see it all, though I have no memory. Somehow I know how these things work. The casual meeting, the exchange of a drink, the appeal of talking to, confiding in, a stranger, one who doesn't judge or take sides because he can't, the gradual acceptance into confidence, leading to what? I've seen the photographs of the two of us, taken years ago. We look happy. It is obvious where those confidences led us. He was attractive, too. Not film star handsome, but better looking than most. It is not difficult to see what drew me. At some point, I must have started scanning the door anxiously as I sat trying to work, thinking more carefully about what clothes I would wear when I went to the cafe, whether to add a dash of perfume. And one day, one or the other of us must have suggested we go for a walk, or to a bar, or maybe even to catch a film. And our friendship slipped over a line, into something else, something infinitely more dangerous. I closed my eyes and tried to imagine it. And as I do, I begin to remember. The two of us, in bed, naked. Semen drying on my stomach, in my hair. Me turning to him as he begins to laugh and kiss me again. Mike, I'm saying. Stop it! You have to leave soon. Ben's back later today and I have to pick Adam up. Stop it! But he doesn't listen. Instead, he leans in, his mustachioed face in mine, and we are kissing again, forgetting about everything, about my husband, about my child. With a sickening plunge, I realize that a memory of this day has come to me before. That day, as I had stood in the kitchen of the house I once shared with my husband, I had not been remembering my husband, but my lover. The man I was fucking while my husband was at work. That's why he had to leave that day. Not just to catch a train, because the man I was married to would be returning home. I open my eyes. I am back in the hotel room and he is still crouching in front of me. Mike, I say. Your name is Mike. You remember, he says. He is pleased. Chris, you remember. Hate bubbles up in me. I remember your name, I say. Nothing else. Just your name. You don't remember how much in love we were? No, I say. I don't think I could ever have loved you. Or surely I would remember more. I say it to hurt him, but his reaction surprises me. You don't remember Ben, though, do you? You can't have loved him. And not Adam, either. You're sick, I say. How fucking dare you? Of course I loved him. He was my son. Is your son. But you wouldn't recognize him if he walked in now, would you? You think that's love? And where is he? And where is Ben? They walked out on you, Christine, both of them. I'm the only one who never stopped loving you. Not even when you left me. It is then that it hits me. Finally. Properly. How else could he have known about this room? About so much of my past? Oh my God, I say. It was you. It was you who did this to me. You who attacked me. He moves over to me then. He wraps his arms around me, as if to embrace me, and begins to stroke my hair. "Christine, darling," he murmurs, "don't say that. Don't think about it. It'll just upset you." I try to push him off me, but he is strong. He squeezes me tighter. "Let me go," I say, "please, let me go." My words are lost in the folds of his shirt. "My love," he says. He has begun to rock me, as if soothing a baby. "My love, my sweet, my darling. You should never have left me, don't you see? None of this would have happened if you hadn't gone." Memory comes again. We are sitting in a car at night. I am crying, and he is staring out of the window, utterly silent. "Say something," I am saying. "Anything. Mike." "You don't mean it," he says. "You can't." "I'm sorry. I love Ben. We have our problems, yes, but I love him. He's the person I'm meant to be with. I'm sorry." I am aware that I'm trying to keep things simple, so that he will understand. I have come to realize over the past few months with Mike that it is better this way. Complicated things confuse him. He likes order, routine, things mixing in precise ratios with predictable results. Plus, I don't want to get too mired in details. "It's because I came round to your house, isn't it? I'm sorry, Chris. I won't do that again, I promise. I just wanted to see you, and I wanted to explain to your husband." I interrupt him. "Ben, you can say his name. It's Ben." "Ben," he says, as if trying the word for the first time and finding it unpleasant. I wanted to explain things to him. I wanted to tell him the truth.
"What truth?"
"That you don't love him anymore. That you love me now. That you want to be with me." That was all I was going to say.
I sigh.
"Don't you see that even if it were true, which it isn't, it's not you who should be saying that to him, it's me. You had no right to just turn up at the house." As I speak, I think about what a lucky escape I've had. Ben was in the shower, Adam playing in the dining room, and I was able to persuade Mike that he ought to go home before either of them were aware of his presence. That was the night I decided I had to end the affair. "I have to go now," I say. I open the car door, step out onto the gravel.
"I'm sorry."
He leans across to look at me. I think how attractive he is. That if he had been less damaged, my marriage might have been in real trouble.
"Will I see you again?" he says.
"No," I reply. "No. It's over." Yet here we are now, all these years later. He is holding me again, and I understand that no matter how scared I was of him, I was not scared enough. I begin to scream. "Darling," he says, "calm down." He puts his hand over my mouth and I scream louder. "Calm down! Someone will hear you!" My head smacks backwards, connects with the radiator behind me. There is no change in the music from the club next door. If anything, it is louder now. "They won't," I think. "They will never hear me." I scream again. "Stop it," he says. He has hit me, I think, or else shaken me. I begin to panic. "Stop it!" My head hits the warm metal again, and I am stunned into silence. I begin to sob. "Let me go," I say, pleading with him. "Please." He relaxes his grip a little, though not enough for me to wriggle free. "How did you find me? All these years later. How did you find me?"
"Find you?" he says. "I never lost you."
My mind whirs, uncomprehending. "I watched over you. Always. I protected you."
"You visited me.
In those places? The hospital? Waring House?" I begin. "But..." He sighs. "Not always. They wouldn't have let me. But I would sometimes tell them I was there to see someone else, or that I was a volunteer, just so that I could see you, and make sure you were all right. At that last place it was easier. All those windows." I go cold.
"You watched me."
"I had to know you were all right, Chris. I had to protect you."
"So you came back for me. Is that it?"
Wasn't what you did here in this room enough? When I found out that bastard had left you, I couldn't just leave you in that place. I knew you'd want to be with me. I knew it was the best thing for you. I had to wait for a while, wait until I knew there was no one still there to try and stop me. But who else would have looked after you? And they just let me go with you? I say, surely they wouldn't have let me go with a stranger. I wonder what lies he must have told for them to let him take me. Then remember reading what Dr. Nash had told me about the woman from Waring House. She was so happy when she found out you'd gone back to live with Ben. An image forms. A memory. My hand in Mike's, as he signs a form. A woman behind a desk smiles at me. We'll miss you, Christine, she says. But you'll be happy at home. She looks at Mike. With your husband. I follow her gaze. I don't recognize the man whose hand I'm holding, but I know he is the man I married. He must be. He has told me he is. Oh, my God, I say now. How long have you been pretending to be Ben? He looks surprised. Pretending? Yes, I say. Pretending to be my husband. He looks confused. I wonder if he's forgotten that he is not Ben. Then his face falls. He looks upset. Do you think I wanted to do that? I had to. It was the only way. His arms relax slightly, and an odd thing happens. My mind stops spinning, and although I remain terrified, I am infused with a bizarre sense of complete calm. A thought comes from nowhere. I will beat him. I will get away. I have to. Mike, I say. I do understand, you know. It must have been difficult. He looks up at me. You do? Yes, of course. I'm grateful to you for coming for me, for giving me a home, for looking after me. Really? Yes. Just think where I'd be if you hadn't. I couldn't bear it. I sense him soften. The pressure on my arms and shoulder lessens and is accompanied by a subtle yet definite sensation of stroking that I find almost more distasteful, but I know is more likely to lead to my escape. Because escape is all I can think of. I need to get away. How stupid of me, I think now, to have sat there on the floor while he was in the bathroom, to read what he had stolen of my journal. Why hadn't I taken it with me and left? Then I remember that it was not until I read the end of the journal that I had any real idea of how much danger I was in. That same small voice comes in again. I will escape. I have a son I cannot remember having met. I will escape. I move my head to face him and begin to stroke the back of his hand where it rests on my shoulder. Why not let me go? And then we can talk about what we should do. How about Claire, though? He says. She knows I'm not Ben. You told her. She won't remember that, I say desperately. He laughs, a hollow, choked sound. He always treated me like I was stupid. I'm not, you know. I know what's going to happen. You told her. You ruined everything. No, I say quickly, I can call her. I can tell her I was confused, that I'd forgotten who you were. I can tell her that I thought you were Ben, but I was wrong. I almost believe he thinks this is possible, but then he says, she'd never believe you. She would, I say, even though I know that she would not. I promise. Why did you have to go and call her? His face clouds with anger. His hands begin to grip me tighter. Why? Why, Chris? We were doing fine until then. Fine. He begins to shake me again. Why? He shouts. Why? Ben, I say, you're hurting me. He hits me then. I hear the sound of his hand against my face before I feel the flash of pain. My head twists round. My lower jaw cracks up, connecting painfully with its companion. Don't you ever fucking call me that again, he spits. Mike, I say quickly, as if I can erase my mistake. Mike! He ignores me. I'm sick of being Ben, he says. You can call me Mike from now on, okay? It's Mike. That's why we came here. So that we can put all that behind us. You wrote in your book that if you could only remember what happened here all those years ago, then you'd get your memory back. Well, we're here now. I made it happen, Chris, so remember.
I am incredulous.
You want me to remember?
Yes, of course I do.
I love you, Christine. I want you to remember how much you love me. I want us to be together again, properly, as we should be.
He pauses. His voice drops to a whisper. I don't want to be Ben anymore. But he looks back at me. When we go back home tomorrow, you can call me Mike.
He shakes me again, his face inches from mine. Okay?
I can smell sourness on his breath, and another smell too. I wonder if he's been drinking.
We're going to be okay, aren't we, Christine? We're going to move on.
Move on, I say. My head is sore, and something is coming out of my nose. Blood, I think, though I'm not sure. The calmness disappears. I raise my voice, shouting as loud as I can.
You want me to go back home? Move on? Are you absolutely fucking crazy?
He moves his hand to clamp it over my mouth, and I realize that he has left my arm free.
I hit out at him, catching him on the side of his face, though not hard. Still, it takes him by surprise. He falls backwards, letting go of my other arm as he does. I stumble to my feet. Bitch, he says, but I step forward over him and head towards the door. I manage 3 steps before he grabs my ankle. I come crashing down. There is a stool sitting tucked under the dressing table, and my head hits its edge as I go down. I'm lucky. The stool is padded and breaks my fall, but it causes my body to twist awkwardly as I land. Pain shoots up my back and through my neck, and I'm afraid I have broken something. I begin to crawl towards the door, but he still holds my ankle. He pulls me towards him with a grunt, and then his crushing weight is on top of me, his lips inches from my ear.
Mike, I sob. Mike! In front of me is the photograph of Adam and Helen, lying on the floor where he had dropped it. Even in the middle of everything else, I wonder how he had got it. And then it hits me. Adam had sent it to me at Waring House, and Mike had taken it, along with all the other photographs, when he'd come for me.
You stupid, stupid bitch, he says, spitting into my ear.
One of his hands is round my throat. With the other he has grabbed a handful of my hair. He pulls my head back, jerking my neck up.
What did you have to go and do that for?
I'm sorry, I sob. I cannot move. One of my hands is trapped beneath my body, the other clamped between my back and his leg.
Where did you think you were going to go, eh?
He says. He is snarling now, an animal. Something like hate floods out of him.
I'm sorry, I say again, because it is all I can think of to say. I'm sorry.
I remember the days when those words would always work, always be enough, be what was needed to get me out of whatever trouble I was in.
Stop saying you're fucking sorry, he says.
My head jerks back, and then slams forward. My forehead, nose, mouth all connect with the carpeted floor. There is a noise, a sickening crunch, and the smell of stale cigarettes. I cry out. There is blood in my mouth. I have bitten my tongue.
Where do you think you're going to run to? You can't drive. You don't know anybody. You don't even know who you are most of the time. You have nowhere to go. Nowhere at all. You're pathetic.
I start to cry, because he is right. I am pathetic. Claire never came. I have no friends. I am utterly alone, relying totally on the man who did this to me. And tomorrow morning, if I survive, I will have forgotten even this. If I survive...
The words echo through me as I realize what this man is capable of, and that this time I may not get out of this room alive. Terror slams into me.
But then I hear the tiny voice again. This is not the place you die. Not with him. Not now. Anything but that. I arch my back painfully and manage to free my arm. Lunging forward, I grab the leg of the stool. It is heavy and the angle of my body wrong, but I manage to twist round and heave it back over my head, where I imagine Mike's head will be.
It strikes something with a satisfying crack. and there is a gasp in my ear. He lets go of my hair. I look round. He's rocked backwards, his hand to his forehead. Blood is beginning to trickle between his fingers. He looks up at me, uncomprehending. Later, I will think how I should have hit him again, with the stool, or with my bare hands, with anything. I should have made sure he was incapacitated, that I could get away, get downstairs, even far enough away that I could open the door and scream for help. But I do not. I pull myself upright and then I stand, looking at him on the floor in front of me. No matter what I do now, I think, he has won. He will always have won. He has taken everything from me, even the ability to remember exactly what he did to me. I turn and begin to move towards the door. With a grunt, he launches himself at me. His whole body collides with mine. Together, we slam into the dresser, stumble towards the door. "Christine," he says. "Chris, don't leave me." I reach out. If I can just open the door, then surely, despite the noise from the club, someone will hear us and come. He clings to my waist, like some grotesque two-headed monster. We inch forward, me dragging him. "Chris, I love you," he says. He is wailing, and this, plus the ridiculousness of his words, spurs me on. I am nearly there. Soon I will reach the door. And then it happens. I remember that night, all those years ago. Me in this room, standing in the same spot. I am reaching out a hand towards the same door. I am happy, ridiculously so. The walls resonate with the soft orange glow of the lit candles that were dotted around the room when I arrived. The air is tinged with the sweet smell of the roses and the bouquet that was on the bed. "I'll be upstairs around 7, my darling," said the note that was pinned to them. And though I wondered briefly what Ben was doing downstairs, I'm glad of the few minutes I have had alone before he arrives. It has given me the opportunity to gather my thoughts, to reflect on how close I came to losing him. What a relief it has been to end the affair with Mike. How fortunate I am that Ben and I are now set on a new trajectory. How could I have thought that I wanted to be with Mike? Mike would never have done what Ben has done. Arrange a surprise night away in a hotel at the coast. To show me how much he loves me, and that despite our recent differences, this will never change. Mike was too inward-looking for that, I have learnt. With him, everything is a test. Affection is measured. That given, weighed against that which has been received. And the balance, more often than not, disappointing him. I am touching the handle of the door, twisting it, pulling it towards me. Ben has taken Adam to stay with his grandparents. We have a whole weekend in front of us, with nothing to worry about. Just the two of us. "Darling," I am starting to say, but the word is choked off in my throat. It's not Ben at the door. It's Mike. He is pushing past me, coming into the room. And even as I'm asking him what he thinks he's doing, what right he has to lure me here, to this room, what he thinks he can achieve, I'm thinking, "You devious bastard. How dare you pretend to be my husband? Do you have no pride left at all?" I think of Ben and Adam at home. By now Ben will be wondering where I am. Possibly he will soon call the police. How stupid I was to get on a train and come here without mentioning it to anybody. How stupid to believe that a typewritten note, even one sprayed with my favorite perfume, was from my husband. Mike speaks. "Would you have come if you'd known it was to meet me?" I laugh. "Of course not. It's over. I told you that before." I look at the flowers, the bottle of champagne he still holds in his hand. Everything smacks of romance, of seduction. "My God," I'm saying, "you really thought you could just lure me here, give me flowers and a bottle of champagne, and that would be it? That I would just fall into your arms and everything would go back to being like it was before? You're crazy, Mike. Crazy. I'm leaving now, going back to my husband and my son." I don't want to remember anymore. I suppose that must have been when he first hit me. But after that, I don't know what happened, what led me from there to the hospital. And now I am here again, in this room. We have turned full circle, though for me all the days between have been stolen. It is as though I never left. I cannot reach the door. He is pulling himself up. I begin to shout, "Help! Help!" "Quiet," he says. "Shut up!" I shout louder, and he swings me round, at the same time pushing me backwards. I fall, and the ceiling and his face slide down in front of me like a curtain descending. My skull hits something hard and unyielding. I realize he has pushed me into the bathroom. I twist my head and see the tiled floor stretching away from me, the bottom of the toilet, the edge of the bath. There is a bar of soap on the floor, sticky and mashed. "Mike," I say, "don't!" But he's crouching over me, his hands around my throat. "Shut up," he is saying over and over, even though I am not saying anything now, just crying. I am gasping for breath. My eyes and mouth are wet with blood and tears, and I don't know what else. "Mike!" I gasp. I cannot breathe. His hands are around my throat and I cannot breathe. Memory floods back. I can remember him holding my head under water. I remember waking up, in a white bed, wearing a hospital gown, and Ben sitting next to me, the real Ben, the one I married. I remember a policewoman asking me questions I cannot answer. A man in pale blue pajamas sitting on the edge of my hospital bed, laughing with me even as he tells me that I greet him every day as if I have never seen him before. A little boy with blonde hair and a tooth missing, calling me Mummy. One after another, the images come. They flood through me. The effect is violent. I shake my head, trying to clear it. But Mike grips me tighter. His head is above mine, his eyes wild and unblinking as he squeezes my throat. And I can remember it being so once before, in this room. I close my eyes. "How dare you," he is saying. And I cannot work out which Mike it is who's speaking. The one here now, or the one who exists only in my memory. "How dare you," he is saying again. "How dare you take my child?" It is then that I remember, when he had attacked me all those years ago, I had been carrying a baby. Not Mike's, but Ben's. The child that was going to be our new start together. Neither of us had survived. I must have blacked out. When I regain consciousness, I am sitting in a chair. I cannot move my hands. The inside of my mouth tastes furry. I open my eyes. The room is dim, lit only by the moonlight streaming in through the open curtains and the reflected yellow streetlights. Mike is sitting opposite me, on the edge of the bed. He is holding something in his hand. I try to speak, but cannot. I realize something is in my mouth. A sock, perhaps. It has been secured somehow, tied in place. And my wrists are tied together, and also my ankles. This is what he wanted all along, I think. Me, silent and unmoving. I struggle, and he notices that I've woken up. He looks up, his face a mask of pain and sadness, and stares at me, right into my eyes. I feel nothing but hate. "You're awake." I wonder if he intends to say anything else, whether he is capable of saying anything else. "This isn't what I wanted. I thought we would come here and it might help you to remember. Remember how things used to be between us. And then we could talk, and I could explain what happened here all those years ago. I never meant for it to happen, Chris. I just get so mad sometimes. I can't help it. I'm sorry. I never wanted to hurt you, ever. I ruined everything." He looks down, into his lap. "There is so much more I used to want to know, yet I am exhausted, and it is too late. I feel as though I could close my eyes and will myself into oblivion, erasing everything. Yet I do not want to sleep tonight, and if I must sleep, then I do not want to wake up tomorrow." It was when you told me you were having a baby. He doesn't lift his head. Instead, he speaks softly into the folds of his clothes, and I have to strain to hear what he is saying. I never thought I'd have a child. Never. They all said... He hesitates, as if changing his mind, deciding that some things are better not shared. You said it wasn't mine, but I knew it was, and I couldn't cope with the thought that you were still going to leave me, going to take my baby away from me, that I might never see him. I couldn't cope, Chris. I still don't know what he wants from me. You think I'm not sorry for what I did? Every day, I see you so bewildered and lost and unhappy. Sometimes I lie there in bed. I hear you wake up, and you look at me, and I know you don't know who I am, and I can feel the disappointment and shame. It comes off you in waves. That hurts, knowing that you'd never sleep with me, now, if you had the choice. And then you get out of bed and go to the bathroom. And I know that in a few minutes you will come back, and you'll be so confused and so unhappy and in so much pain. He pauses. And now I know even that will be over soon. I've read your journal. I know your doctor will have worked it out by now. Or he will do soon. Claire, too. I know they'll come for me. He looks up. And they'll try to take you away from me. But Ben doesn't want you. I do. I want to look after you. Please, Chris. Please remember how much you loved me. Then you can tell them that you want to be with me. He points to the last few pages of my journal, scattered on the floor. You can tell them that you forgive me. For this. And we can be together. I shake my head. I cannot believe he wants me to remember. He wants me to know what he has done. He smiles. You know, sometimes I think it might have been kinder if you died that night. Kinder for both of us. He looks out of the window. I would join you, Chris, if that's what you wanted. He looks down again. It would be easy enough. You could go first, and I promise you I would follow. You do trust me, don't you? He looks at me, expectantly. Would you like that? He says. It would be painless. I shake my head. Try to speak. Fail. My eyes are burning. And I can hardly breathe. No. He looks disappointed. No. I suppose any life is better than none. Very well. You're probably right. I begin to cry. He shakes his head. Chris. This will all be fine. You see? This book is the problem. He holds up my journal. We were happy, before you started writing this. Or as happy as we could be, anyway. And that was happy enough, wasn't it? We should just get rid of this. And then maybe you could tell them you were confused. And we could go back to how it was before. For a little while, at least. He stands up and slides the metal bin from beneath the dresser, takes out the empty liner and discards it. It'll be easy, then. He says. He puts the bin on the floor between his legs. Easy. He drops my journal into the bin and gathers the last few pages that are still littering the floor and adds those. We have to get rid of it, he says. All of it. Once and for all. He takes a box of matches out of his pocket, strikes one, and retrieves a single page from the bin. I look at him in horror. No! I try to say. Nothing comes out but a muffled grunt. He doesn't look at me as he sets fire to the single page, and then drops it into the bin.
No,
I say again, but this time it is a silent scream in my head. I watch my history begin to burn to ash, my memories reduce to carbon. My journal, the letter from Ben, everything. I am nothing without that journal, I think. Nothing. And he has won. I do not plan to do what I do next. It is instinctive. I launch my body at the bin. With my hands tied, I cannot break my fall, and I hit it awkwardly, hearing something snap as I twist. Pain shoots from my arm, and I think I will faint, but I don't. The bin falls over, scattering burning paper across the floor. Mike cries out, a shriek, and falls to his knees, slapping the ground, trying to put out the flames. I see that a burning shred has come to rest under the bed, unnoticed by Mike. Flames are beginning to lick at the edge of the bedspread, but I can neither reach it nor cry out. And so I simply lie there, watching the bedspread catch fire. It begins to smoke, and I close my eyes. The room will burn, I think, and Mike will burn, and I will burn, and no one will ever really know what happened here, in this room, just like no one will ever really know what happened here all those years ago, and history will turn to ash and be replaced by conjecture. I cough, a dry, heaving wretch, swallowed by the sock bald in my throat. I'm beginning to choke. I think of my son. I will never see him now, though at least I'll die knowing I had one, and that he is alive and happy. For that I'm glad. I think of Ben, the man I married and then forgot. I want to see him. I want to tell him that now, at the end, I can remember him. I can remember meeting him at the rooftop party, and him proposing to me on a hill looking out over a city. And I can remember marrying him in the church in Manchester, having our photographs taken in the rain. And yes, I can remember loving him. I know that I do love him, and I always have. Things go dark. I can't breathe. I can hear the lap of flames and feel their heat. Manchester, having our photographs taken in the rain. And yes, I can remember loving him. I know that I do love him, and I always have. Things go dark. I can't breathe. I can hear the lap of flames and feel their heat on my lips and eyes. There were never going to be any happy endings for me. I know that now. But that is all right. That is all right. I am lying down. I have been asleep, but not for long. I can remember who I am, where I have been. I can hear the noise, the roar of traffic, a siren that is neither rising nor falling in pitch but remaining constant. Something is over my mouth. I think of a bald sock, yet I find I can breathe. I am too frightened to open my eyes. I do not know what I will see. But I must. I have no choice but to face whatever my reality has become. The light is bright. I can see a fluorescent tube on the low ceiling, and two metal bars running parallel to it. The walls are close by on each side, and they are hard, shiny with metal and perspex. I can make out drawers and shelves stocked with bottles and packets, and there are machines blinking. Everything is moving slightly, vibrating, including, I realize, the bed in which I am lying. A man's face appears from somewhere behind me, over my head. He's wearing a green shirt. I don't recognize him. "She's awake, everybody," he says. And then more faces appear. I scan them quickly. Mike is not among them. And I relax a little. "Christine," comes a voice. "Chrissy, it's me." It's a woman's voice, one I recognize. "We're on our way to the hospital. You've broken your collarbone, but you're going to be all right. Everything's going to be fine. He's dead. That man is dead. He can't hurt you anymore. I see the person speaking then. She's smiling and holding my hand. It's Claire. The same Claire I saw just the other day. Not the young Claire I might expect to see after just waking up. And I notice her earrings are the same pair that she had on the last time I saw her. Claire, I say, but she interrupts. Don't speak, she says. Just try to relax. She leans forward and strokes my hair and whispers something in my ear. But I don't hear what. It sounds like, I'm sorry. I remember, I say. I remember. She smiles, and then she steps back and a young man takes her place. He has a narrow face and is wearing thick-rimmed glasses. For a moment I think it is Ben, until I realize that Ben would be my age now. Mom, he says. Mom? He looks the same as he did in the picture of him and Helen, and I realize I remember him too. Adam, I say, words choke in my throat as he hugs me. Mum, he says. Dad's coming. He'll be here soon. I pull him to me and breathe in the smell of my boy, and I am happy. I can wait no longer. It is time. I must sleep. I have a private room, and so there is no need for me to observe the strict routines of the hospital. But I am exhausted, my eyes already beginning to close. It is time. I have spoken to Ben, to the man I really married. We talked for hours, it seems, though it may only have been a few minutes. He told me that he flew in as soon as the police contacted him.
The police?
Yes, he said. When they realized you weren't living with the person Waringhouse thought you were, they traced me. I'm not sure how. I suppose they had my old address and went from there.
So where were you?
He pushed his glasses up the bridge of his nose. I've been in Italy for a few months, he said. I've been working out there. He paused. I thought you were okay. He took my hand. I'm sorry. You couldn't have known, I said. He looked away. I left you, Chrissy. I know everything. Claire told me. I read your letter. I thought it was for the best, he said. I really did. I thought it would help. Help you. Help Adam. I tried to get on with my life, I really did. He hesitated. I thought I could only do that if I divorced you. I thought it would free me. Adam didn't understand, even when I explained to him that you wouldn't even know, wouldn't even remember being married to me. Did it? I said. Did it help you move on? He turned to me. I won't lie to you, Chrissy. There have been other women. Not many, but some. It's been a long time. Years and years. At first nothing serious, but then I met someone a couple of years ago. I moved in with her, but? Well, that ended. She said I didn't love her. That I'd never stopped loving you. And she was right. He did not reply, and so, fearing his answer, I said, So what happens now? Tomorrow, will you take me back to Waringhouse? He looked up at me. No, he said. She was right. I never stopped loving you. And I won't take you there again. Tomorrow, I want you to come home. Now I look at him. He sits in a chair next to me, and although he is already snoring, his head tipped forward at an awkward angle, he still holds my hand. I can just make out his glasses. The scar running down the side of his face. My son has left the room to phone his girlfriend and whisper a good night to his unborn daughter. and my best friend is outside in the car park, smoking a cigarette. No matter what, I am surrounded by the people I love. Earlier, I spoke to Dr. Nash. He told me I had left the care home almost 4 months ago, a little while after Mike had started visiting, claiming to be Ben. I had discharged myself, signed all the paperwork. I had left voluntarily. They couldn't have stopped me, even if they'd believed there was a reason for them to try. When I left, I took with me the few photographs and personal possessions that I still had. "That was why Mike had those pictures," I said. "The ones of me and Adam. That's why he had the letter that Adam had written to Santa Claus. His birth certificate."
"Yes," said Dr. Nash. "They were with you at Waring House, and they went with you when you left. At some point, Mike must have destroyed all the pictures that showed you with Ben, possibly even before you were discharged from Waring House. The staff turnover is fairly high, and they had no idea what your husband really looked like."
"But how would he have got access to the photographs?"
"They were in an album in a drawer in your room. It would have been easy enough for him to get to them once he started visiting you. He might have even slipped in a few photographs of himself. He must have had some of the two of you taken during, well, when you were seeing each other years ago. The staff at Waring House were convinced that the man who had been visiting you was the same one as in the photo album.
So I brought my photos back to Mike's house and he hid them in a metal box. Then he invented a fire to explain why there were so few."
"Yes," he said. He looked tired and guilty. I wondered whether he blamed himself for any of what had happened, and I hoped he didn't. He had helped me, after all. He had rescued me. I hoped he would still be able to write his paper and present my case. I hoped he would be recognized for what he had done for me. After all, without him, I don't want to think about where I'd be.
"How did you find me?" I said.
He explained that Claire had been frantic with worry after we'd spoken, but she had waited for me to call the next day. Mike must have removed the pages from your journal that night. That was why you didn't think anything was wrong when you gave me the journal on Tuesday, and neither did I. When you didn't call her, Claire tried to phone you, but she only had the number for the mobile phone I had given you, and Mike had taken that too. I should have known something was wrong when I called you on that number this morning and you didn't answer. But I didn't think. I just called you on your other phone." He shook his head.
"It's okay," I said. "Go on."
"It's fair to assume he'd been reading your journal for at least the last week or so, probably longer. At first, Claire couldn't get hold of Adam and didn't have Ben's number, so she called Waring House. They only had one number that they thought was for Ben, but in fact it was Mike's. Claire didn't have my number. She called the school he worked at and persuaded them to give her Mike's address and phone number, but both were false. She was at a dead end.
I think of this man discovering my journal, reading it every day. Why didn't he destroy it? Because I'd written that I loved him, and because that was what he wanted me to carry on believing. Or maybe I'm being too kind to him. Maybe he just wanted me to see it burn." "Claire didn't call the police."
"She did," he nodded. "But it was a few days before they really took it seriously. In the meantime, she'd got hold of Adam and he'd told her that Ben had been abroad for a while, and that as far as he knew, you were still in Waring House. She contacted them, and though they wouldn't give her your home address, they eventually relented and gave Adam my number. They must have thought that was a good compromise, as I'm a doctor. Claire only got through to me this afternoon."
"This afternoon?"
"Yes. Claire convinced me something was wrong, and of course finding out that Adam was alive confirmed it. We came to see you at home, but by then you'd already left for Brighton."
"How did you know to find me there?"
"You told me this morning that Mike, had told you that you were going away for the weekend. You said he'd told you that you were going to the coast. Once Claire told me what was going on, I guessed where he was taking you."
I lay back. I felt tired. Exhausted. I wanted only to sleep, but was frightened too. Frightened of what I might forget. "But you told me Adam was dead," I said.
You said he'd been killed. When we were sitting in the car park. And the fire, too. You told me there'd been a fire. He smiled sadly. Because that's what you told me. I told him I didn't understand. One day, a couple of weeks after we first met, you told me Adam was dead. Evidently, Mike had told you, and you had believed him and told me. When you asked me in the car park, I told you the truth as I believed it. It was the same with the fire. I believed there'd been one, because that's what you told me. But I remembered Adam's funeral, I said. His coffin. Again the sad smile. Your imagination. But I saw pictures, I said. That man... I found it impossible to say Mike's name. He showed me pictures of me and him together, of us getting married. I found a picture of a gravestone. It had Adam's name. He must have faked them, he said. Faked them? Yes. On a computer. It's really quite easy to mock up photos these days. He must have guessed you were suspecting the truth and left them where he knew you'd find them. It's quite likely that some of the photos you thought were of the two of you were also faked. I thought of the times I had written that Mike was in his office, working. Is that what he'd been doing? How thoroughly he had betrayed me. Are you okay? Said Dr. Nash. I smiled. Yes, I said. I think so. I looked at him and realized I could picture him in a different suit, with his hair cut much shorter. I can remember things, I said. His expression did not change. What things? He said. I remember you with a different haircut, I said. And I recognized Ben, too, and Adam and Claire, in the ambulance. And I can remember seeing her the other day. We went to the cafe at Alexandra Palace. We had coffee. She has a son called Toby. His eyes were sad. Have you read your journal today? He said. Yes, I said. But don't you see? I can remember things that I didn't write down. I can remember the earrings that she was wearing. They're the same ones she has on now. I asked her. She said I was right. And I can remember that Toby was wearing a blue parka, and that he had cartoons on his socks. And I remember he was upset because he wanted apple juice, and they only had orange or blackcurrant. Don't you see? I didn't write those things down. I can remember them. He looked pleased then, though still cautious. Dr. Paxton did say that he could find no obvious organic cause for your amnesia. That it seems likely that it was at least partly caused by the emotional trauma of what had happened to you, as well as the physical. I suppose it's possible that another trauma might reverse that, at least to some degree. I leapt on what he was suggesting. So I might be cured, I said. He looked at me intently. I had the feeling that he was weighing up what to say, how much of the truth I could stand. I have to say it's unlikely, he said. There's been a degree of improvement over the last few weeks, but nothing like a complete return of memory. But it is possible. I felt a rush of joy. Doesn't the fact that I remember what happened a week ago mean that I can form new memories again? And keep them? He spoke hesitantly. It would suggest that, yes, but, Christine, I want you to be prepared for the fact that the effect may well be temporary. We won't know until tomorrow. When I wake up? Yes, it's entirely possible that after you sleep tonight, all the memories you have from today will be gone. All the new ones. And all the old ones. It might be exactly the same as when I woke up this morning. Yes, he said. It might. That I might wake up and have forgotten Adam and Ben seemed too much to contemplate. It felt like it would be a living death. But, I began. Keep your journal, Christine, he said. You still have it? I shook my head. He burnt it. That's what caused the fire. Dr. Nash looked disappointed. That's a shame, he said. But it doesn't really matter, Christine. You'll be fine. You can begin another.
The people who love you have come back to you.
But I want to have come back to them, too, I said. I want to have come back to them. We talked for a little while longer, but he was keen to leave me with my family. I know he was only trying to prepare me for the worst, for the possibility that I will wake up tomorrow morning with no idea where I am, or who this man sitting next to me is, or who the person is who is claiming to be my son. But I have to believe that he is wrong, that my memory is back. I have to believe that. I look at my sleeping husband, silhouetted in the dim room. I remember us meeting, that night at the party, the night I watched the fireworks with Claire on the roof. I remember him asking me to marry him, on holiday in Verona, and the rush of excitement I'd felt as I said yes. And our wedding too. Our marriage. Our life. I remember it all. I smile. I love you, I whisper, and I close my eyes, and I sleep. Before I Go to Sleep, by S.J. Watson, was read by Susanna Harker. Before I Go to Sleep is published by the Random House Group Limited in association with Audio Go Limited. Copyright Lola Communications Limited, 2011. S.J. Watson has asserted his right under the CDPA 1988 to be identified as the author of this work.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.